Good evening and welcome to Behind the News for April 26, 2007, as the woman said. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. I've got the usual two segments up tonight. First, in about 5 minutes or so, we'll listen to an interview recorded earlier this week with Rachel Sherman, who is a sociologist who spent some time working and observing life in a couple of luxury hotels in undisclosed locations. And very interesting about on the production of luxury, but also consciousness and class relations that develop in this rather elite venue. And then at the bottom of the hour, several guests will be speaking about climate change, the issue of climate change, centering on the nation's special issue on that topic, which came out last week. We'll be joined in the studio by the issue's guest editor, Christian Parenti. We'll hear a recorded interview with Elizabeth Economy of the Council on Foreign Relations on the Chinese contribution to greenhouse gas emissions. And I'll also talk a little bit about my own contribution to that issue, which is what elites are up to, what the corporate and financial elite is thinking about climate change, and quite a dramatic change from a couple of years ago when they were hostile to the idea or indifferent. They seem to be embracing it, but what does it mean? And before we get there, just a couple of observations. The economic news. Yesterday, Alpha, a trade magazine published by Institutional Investor, released its annual list of the biggest earners among the hedge fund chiefs for 2006. Hedge funds, I should say, are pools of speculative capital assembled from rich individuals and financial institutions that move in and out of a variety of investments, often with lightning speed. The managers, if they're good at what they do, can get very rich. And this gang is very rich. At the top of the list for last year was Jim Simons of Renaissance Technologies, who pulled down $1.7 billion. That's billion with a B. Just behind him were Ken Griffin of Citadel Investment Group at $1.4 billion and Eddie Lampert of ESL Investments, his initials, of course, at $1.3 billion. Together, the top 25 took in almost $15 billion last year, more than the GDP of Jordan, as the Financial Times noted, or enough to pay the entire 80,000 faculty of the New York City public schools teachers for nearly 3 years, as the New York Times noted. While the top guys usually get there by making a lot of money for their investors, who I might point out are generally pretty rich to start with, there are very few managers who consistently do well. And the average hedge fund, after you consider all the risks involved, not to mention the high fees taken by their managers, generally do little better than the broad stock market. But thanks to the triumph of hope over experience, investors constantly try to beat the market. One who has, a rare one who has, for almost 50 years is George Soros, number 4 on this year's list, and another is number 7, Paul Tudor Jones. And today's Financial Times reports that Paul Tudor Jones is throwing his support behind Barack Obama's campaign for president, as is George Soros. So if these guys are as good at picking candidates as they are at picking investments, then we may have a President Obama in our future. But the election is a long way away, so who knows? Evidently, Jones and Soros aren't the only ones. The FT quotes an anonymous source as saying the whole of Greenwich is backing Obama. Greenwich, Connecticut is where a lot of the hedge fund business is based. It's a bit of an exaggeration to say the whole of Greenwich is backing Obama. Some support Hillary, and one prominent hotshot, Stephen Cohen, supports native son Christopher Dodd. And one or two of these hedge fund managers are actually Republicans. But it looks like most are leaning Democrat this time, which is pretty interesting. Okay, enough news for now. This is a jam-packed program. Let's take a musical break, and we'll be back to hear from Rachel Sherman.
Shut the fan.
And that a bit of Graham Parker's song from a little over 30 years ago, Hotel Chambermaid, which is lyrically inappropriate to the next segment, but it does have the word hotel in its title. The next segment is an interview I recorded earlier this week with Rachel Sherman, who is a professor of sociology at Yale, who's been teaching this semester at NYU. And her book is called Class Acts, Service and Inequality in Luxury Hotels, just out from the University of California Press. And she spent some time working in and observing the culture of some luxury hotels in an undisclosed location. This is the requirements of research. Can't tell you which hotels or where they were, but they really were hotels, which cater to the people who do have $1 million. So let's listen to Rachel Sherman. Welcome, Rachel. First of all, just give us a background on how you did your research.
I basically started off by interviewing managers in different kinds of hotels and became interested in luxury hotels specifically. And then I got permission to work first in one hotel where I was for about 8 months working in a variety of different jobs, and then in the second hotel where I worked for 4 months primarily as a concierge.
All right, let's get down to the meat of the issue. You would think, just hearing about this project, that you would have discovered seething resentment. Hotel workers, these are not badly paid people, but not paid enormous amounts of money, dealing with, as one person put it, the top 1% of the income distribution. Yet there is not an awful lot of seething resentment, not of, under the surface class conflict. Why not?
You know, that is sort of the central question of the book. And I had really expected to see, these were workers whose job it is to offer their emotional and physical labor in every way to guests, to make sure that they're happy, to call them by name, to get them whatever they want, and so on. And so I had thought that there would maybe not even be resentment, but at least some sort of class awareness of some kind. And as you say, I really didn't find that. There's several explanations for why. One is the overarching thing is basically that workers sort of found ways to constitute themselves as not subordinate to guests. So they resisted seeing themselves as subordinate, as powerless, as dominated in any way. And they did this in a number of ways. So one way that they did it was to judge guests, sort of situate themselves as superior to guests by judging them or by empathizing with them, by kind of caring for them, kind of looking down on them in the sense that they, guests are tired or they don't know where they are, they need our help. So there's a sort of condescending empathy that workers felt for guests. But as you might expect, they did also really judge them harshly in terms of, what they were wearing, how smart they were, what they knew about stuff, how they treated workers. And they were constantly making judgments behind guests' back. At the same time, though, workers also tended to develop fairly meaningful relations with guests. And this obviously varies according to how often the guest was in the hotel. But overall, workers became invested in their relationships with guests. And there was, corresponding to the lack of sort of overt resistance or seething class resentment, there was also much less bad treatment of workers by guests than I would have expected. And maybe I was naive to expect that. But as it turned out, workers were treated very well by guests, and guests would remember the worker's name and tip them generously and ask them how they were doing and thank them for whatever they had done and bring them, a baseball hat or a bottle of wine or, some kind of gift like that. And this happened quite often. And so workers came to expect that sort of reciprocity from guests. And when they didn't get it, then they would get upset and sort of take revenge in certain kinds of ways. But for the most part, guest reciprocity toward workers sort of preserved this, I would say, illusion of equality between workers and guests and helped workers not think of themselves as subordinated to guests.
And although most of the relations between guests and employees were pretty friendly, occasionally there are some really annoying guests and the workers take revenge on them. Tell us about those little acts of war.
I mean, this is one of those things I was saying before, that resistance, people tend to see resistance in this kind of work. And I think this is something that other scholars might characterize more as evidence of kind of class consciousness or some resistance to this unequal social order. I characterize it as revenge because, as I said, guests who treat workers badly are essentially violating a contract of reciprocity. So they, workers see guests as having an obligation to be nice to them or to tip them or whatever. And when guests fail to tip, or when they talk to workers rudely, or they treat them as invisible, workers will take certain kinds of revenge depending on what kind of worker it is. So, you know, they'll do things like roll their eyes, or, you know, type a nasty word about the guest into the computer or something for other workers to see. But they would also give the guest a bad room, or, you know, not give him a discounted rate, or park his car, you know, at the back of the garage where it would take, you know, 15 minutes to get it out. Those were the kind of hidden mechanisms of revenge, where they wouldn't be as nice to guests as otherwise they would be. They would never be overtly rude, but sometimes they would be sort of just polite and flat rather than really going out of their way to engage with the guest.
I'm speaking with Rachel Sherman, a professor of sociology at Yale, who's been teaching this semester at NYU, and who is the author of the book Class Act, Service and Inequality in Luxury Hotels, just published by the University of California Press. Now, there's a line, a common line, in the analysis of service work in that there's something false about it, that workers have to put on phony smiles, pretend to be friendly to people that they're not feeling particularly friendly towards. You didn't see much of that. And is there something unique about the luxury hotel, or is this a thing that service work in general is not the way we might think it is?
I mean, I kind of think it's both. You know, there's, on the one hand, I think that analysts tend to look for class resentment and collective action, or people getting ready to start a revolution or something, and they tend to see that in ways that I think are overstated. So, you know, I didn't study other kinds of service work, but I think that in general, people do want to be invested in their jobs. You know, they don't want to be just pissed off all the time. And so I think that I'm highlighting something that's probably true in many places. But I also think it's especially true in the luxury hotel there's several reasons for this. The workers are more likely to be treated well in the luxury hotel than they are at the McDonald's or even at the Holiday Inn, probably. They have more discretion because many of the features of luxury service involve workers making choices about stuff. So workers in these hotels, they aren't subject to routines the way workers at McDonald's are. You know, they don't have to just say the same thing over and over again. They're responding to the particular needs and characteristics of each guest, and therefore they have a pretty wide range of choice about how they do stuff. And that, in general, I think makes any worker happier. And as you mentioned initially, these workers were not underpaid. They weren't as, you know, nearly as well paid as the guests that stayed in the hotel, but they were reasonably well paid because they were working in a city with high union density. And so they didn't have the kind of low wages or bad working conditions that, you know, workers at a Walmart or a McDonald's or someplace that we associate more with routine low-wage service work would have.
There's a great social distance between the guests and the workers. Does that contribute at all to the civil relations between them?
You know, it's hard for me to answer that because I don't have any comparative case where that isn't true. In general, yes, I think that typically scholars who've looked at this would say that the closer sort of in status workers and clients are, the more tension there is between them because clients need to differentiate themselves in terms of status. They need to work harder to do that. So they have to, you know, put workers down or assert their authority more explicitly. And certainly guests in a luxury hotel don't have to do that. There's also a question of kind of noblesse oblige and, you know, that wealthy people typically have historically, especially in the old rich class, have typically treated servants well. And there's a kind of idea that that's how you're supposed to do that. So, yeah, but I also think that guests are invested in having relationships with workers that are friendly. You know, they don't want to see the workers as servants. So they're not sort of saying, well, we have to treat the workers nicely because that's how we treat our maid at home. You know, they're saying we have to treat the workers nicely because that's how, you know, our clients treat us, kind of. That they want to make, they're also trying to minimize the perception of inequality between themselves and the workers.
Well, and some of the guests themselves feel a little nervous about their own status, don't they?
Yeah, well, that was a really fascinating thing that I hadn't expected at all, was that guests, I also did interviews with guests as well as the participant observation in the hotel, and guests unrelated to the hotels themselves, the interviews that I did, but many of the people that I talked about feeling nervous in the hotel, like they didn't belong in the hotel. They were worried that the workers were judging them. They were not at all secure with their kind of class prerogatives, and that was something, ironically, that then it becomes the worker's job to make the guest comfortable in the hotel and essentially sort of create the guest as somebody who is entitled to this kind of service, to the worker's labor, and so on. But the guests were, not for political reasons too much, although sometimes they were a little bit guilty just about inequality, but also they were worried that they were going to wear the wrong thing or say the wrong thing or not tip right or, you know, somehow misbehave in the hotel.
Yeah, how does one learn those things? I've always wondered this myself. How do you learn exactly how much to tip or who to tip under what circumstances? Is this something that that the workers themselves socialize the guests into?
Yeah, you know, that's something even I should be able to answer that question, I think, better than I can. I never, very rarely saw explicitly something like that happening. I mean, occasionally some guests would say, you know, am I supposed to tip you? Or how much do I tip the massage therapist? Or, you know, is this newspaper sitting on this table free? But that was so much rarer than the sort of unspoken mechanisms. But when I interviewed the guests, they would say, well, after you stay in the hotel a few times, you realize what's going on. And I really don't know if they actually have to ask workers how much they're supposed to be tipping or who they're supposed to be tipping, or if that's something they figure out from their own peers, because it wasn't something that I saw explicitly in the hotel. And the other thing is that I think is really interesting about that is that the money relations between workers and guests are supposed to be hidden all the time. So you're not supposed to just hand the worker $20. You know, you're supposed to fold it up or put it in an envelope, and nobody's supposed to really look at it while it's being handed over. And so there's this kind of idea that money itself is invisible. And in general,
is that because both sides are invested in the idea that this is a personal relationship?
Yeah, I think so. And in general, guests are very invested in not seeing the kind of commodified dimension of their stay. So there would be, you know, guests would write on comment cards to the hotel, like, how can you charge money for the minibar? You know, I'm paying $500 a night. You should charge $525 and make the minibar complimentary. So it's not that they care about the amount of money. It's that they care that they have to think about the money, you know, in addition to just whatever the regular room rate is that they're paying. And part of that is because they want to see the hotel as an experience that sort of transcends money. They don't want to always be thinking about the money that they're spending, and they certainly want to see the relationships with workers as genuine on the part of workers. I mean, they don't want to think that workers are just being nice to them because they're going to get a tip. Although they do refer to, both workers and guests, refer to tipping as taking care of. So, you know, someone will say, like, did my husband take care of you, to a worker, asking whether or not they've been tipped. And so there's a very euphemistic language around it as well.
What about the relations among the workers themselves? Are they, do they compete with each other? Are they stratified by hierarchy, gender, ethnicity? Or do they see solidarity among themselves? What about that?
Yeah, I think that really depends. They're certainly not unified in some kind of class-conscious way. They were certainly, and this was different in the two hotels. At the Royal Court, which is the smaller boutique independent hotel, workers in some ways were sort of unified against management because management was kind of incompetent. So workers were often criticizing managers or making fun of managers and so on. But there, and at the Luxury Garden, which was the more professional corporate hotel, that happened less often because management itself was more professional. At the Royal Court, there was also more competition among workers, you know, sometimes for tips, sometimes for work that would ultimately result in a tip, and some occasionally conflict between workers in the front of the house, the interactive workers who deal with guests, and those in the back of the house who are mostly housekeeping, other kinds of invisible workers who don't see guests that much. Sometimes there would be conflicts, mostly because housekeeping workers would maybe make a mistake, and then the person who has to deal with that is the front desk worker who, you know, has to talk to the angry client about something bad that happened in their room. So there were divisions like that, mostly having to do with how labor was allocated and how tips were allocated. But for the most part, in both hotels, you know, relationships among workers were very friendly and positive, if not kind of super united in a kind of solidarity sense.
I'm speaking with Rachel Sherman, a professor of sociology at Yale, who's been teaching this semester at NYU, and who is the author of the book Class Act, Service and Inequality in Luxury Hotels, just published by the University of California Press. How generalizable, if at all, do you think this is towards other forms of service work, certainly Walmart cashiers or even Motel 6 desk clerks? Are these completely different worlds, or is there enough of a commonality that you can say that this is characteristic of this kind of you-have-to-be-there service work?
Yeah, again, I mean, because I didn't do any kind of systematic study of other kinds of service work, this is necessarily speculative. But I think that in general, you know, workers' desire to find meaning in their work, to not feel subordinated in their work, to play games around particular aspects of their work. In the case of the hotel workers, it's often around tipping, and I think most tipped workers do this in other kinds of settings as well. I think workers use judgments of themselves and others, again, to sort of cast themselves as superior. I think they want to see themselves as equal. So these are sort of principles of things that I saw in the hotel that I think play out in other workplaces as well. And I think most people, you just think about your own job. You know, you can think about how those things are constantly happening. The people don't want to feel subordinated or belittled or lesser. And so they always find ways to do that, even if they have jobs that are low status or low paid or whatever the case may be. How this actually happens, I think, is different in different kinds of places. So the sorts of judgments that workers make of guests are going to be really different in the luxury hotel than they're going to be in the Walmart, or the kinds of relationships that workers at the luxury hotel and those at the Walmart are invested in with guests, are the particular characteristics of those are going to be different. So I suspect that in principle, a lot of the things that I found are generalizable, but in sort of the specifics of it, they're probably different.
And then what about broader implications for social political relations in the society at large? Does this suggest that it's very difficult to organize service workers into unions? Those of us looking for a little more intensity in the class war will be disappointed in some of your findings. What's the moral here?
Yeah, I mean, it is a little disappointing in that way. And this is something, you know, I'm finding stuff that union organizers already know. And I got into this research because I worked for a while in a volunteer capacity with the Hotel and Restaurant Workers Union. And, you know, organizers there would say, well, it's always harder to organize the people at the front desk than it is to organize the people in the back of the house, partly because the people at the front desk consider themselves professionals and because they have these relationships with guests. And that's essentially what I also found, you know, that having relationships with guests and doing the kind of work that you do that's interactive allows these workers to think of themselves not really as workers. You know, they don't want, they see something sort of derogatory about the idea of being workers. And I worked with one doorman who I used the word workers, and he said, oh, yeah, the proletariat. Like, you know, that has nothing to do with me. And so I think that these are entrenched ways of thinking about, you know, that workers use to think about themselves, and it does make it hard for them to identify collectively with each other and to identify sort of in opposition to the guests whom they're serving. The bigger point beyond just sort of particularly worker consciousness or the, you know, kind of class war possibilities is, and what I think is of, you know, greater importance about the book, is the way that these workers are, even as they're symbolically kind of creating themselves as powerful, you know, they see themselves as equal to guests or superior to them. You know, they're especially skilled, they're professional. At the same time that they are creating themselves as powerful, they are also legitimating a system, you know, and normalizing, causing to become taken for granted a system of radical inequality in which they're participating. So their own capacity to see themselves as powerful or as equal comes, the sort of long-term consequence of that is that it prevents them from ever developing a more critical approach to, you know, social inequality or class politics. And they end up interpreting their relations with people in the hotel, whether they're managers or other workers or guests, in pretty much exclusively individual terms. So these operate against the possibility of creating collectives of workers. Because even if one worker will say, you know, well, that guest is such an idiot, you know, I'm going to give him a bad room, or I'm going to, you know, not give him the best rate or whatever, that's they're sort of seeing that person as an outlier, as an individual transgressor of the general rules of how workers are supposed to be treated. They never sort of put all of those guests in a class together to be evaluated in a similar way. And so I think it's sort of one of the ways, and again, I think this is something that happens all the time. I mean, we're constantly trying to make sense of inequality, and we end up making sense of it through kind of individual evaluations or interpretations rather than being able to really come up with structural critiques that would allow workers or whoever to become more invested in collective action or political action.
Yeah, it's interesting that this world is very different from the factory, where you're creating an alienated commodity for sale very far from the place of work, whereas, you know, this kind of personal interaction, especially in a luxury hotel, where you're helping to form the sense of entitlement among the upper classes that are there, it creates a very different political and imaginative environment, doesn't it?
Yeah, and I think it's an environment that we're not very good at theorizing politically. I mean, you know, a lot of, certainly in sociology, and I think in, you know, sort of lefty politics generally, we still have this idea of the alienated worker on the shop floor. And what we fail to see is that in service work, which, you know, overwhelmingly dominates our economy, the worker is not distant from the product of his or her labor. And that product, in most cases, to a certain extent, and in a luxury hotel to a great extent, consists of an interaction between the worker and the client. So the client is participating in production. We can't separate production and consumption. And that makes it hard to imagine a sort of alternative regime of kind of production consumption in which we don't have, where in which inequality between workers and managers or employers or capitalists is eliminated, but also this inequality in consumption between workers and clients is eliminated. And that's sort of the axis that I'm trying to look at.
And that was the voice of Rachel Sherman, who is a professor of sociology at Yale and author of the book Class Acts, Service and Inequality in Luxury Hotels, just out from the University of California Press. And this is WBAI, 99.5 on your FM dial in New York. My name is Doug Henwood. The program is Behind the News. Let's take a little musical break, and we'll be back to speak with Christian Parenti about climate change. And add a bit of Los Angeles is Burning by Bad Religion, which is a good setup for a climate catastrophe. Now we're joined in the studio by Christian Parenti, who is the guest editor of the Nation's special issue on climate change, which came out last week. And I said just a few words before we get to the interview. I've been talking a lot more about climate change on this show because I think it's probably the most urgent issue facing us. Yes, there's imperialist war and capitalist exploitation and all manner of bigotry and oppression, but climate change really does seem to threaten life itself. Just before turning to Christian, a bit of news. The Congressional Budget Office released a study today of the economic effects of a 15% reduction in carbon emissions in the U.S. One finding is that assuming that costs were passed along to consumers, the poorest 20% of the population would see their annual bills rise by about $560 a year, or 3% of their after-tax income. The middle 60% of the population would see its expenses rise by about just under 3%. The richest 20% would see its cost rise by just 2% of total after-tax income. So any just policy would have to insulate the poor and soak the rich because the market alone will not take care of that. Okay, welcome to Behind the News, Christian.
Thank you very much for having me on.
You made your reputation.
Thanks for your great piece in this issue as well.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for asking me to do it. You made your reputation as a writer on prisons, surveillance, imperial war. So why now climate change? It's a bit of a change for you.
Well, because I live in this climate that's changing. And in fact, actually, the first pieces I ever wrote were about the ozone layer. I've always been concerned with the environment, but I'm not trying to model myself as some expert on climate change, but you know, as a reporter, that's one of the privileges. You don't have to be an expert to write about stuff. You can just research it and get into it. And so I've written a few pieces about climate change recently, or this issue, and something for Canadian magazine, The Walrus. And it's a burning, you know, it's a burning topic, and it's terrifying. The fact that industrial society is on a collision course with nature, that we're loading more carbon dioxide into the atmosphere than the system can handle. And there's the main problem, it seems, and this is relatively new science, is that they think that climate change happens in a rather nonlinear fashion, so that the effects lag so much the causes that when you start feeling the effects of accumulated greenhouse gases, particularly carbon dioxide, by the time you start feeling those effects, you might be in store for such radical changes that you can't respond to the effects in time to deal with the underlying causes.
Now, as I recall, that even if we were to stop emitting greenhouse gases today, the temperature would still continue to rise because of what's up there already, right?
Yeah, it would rise for another 30 years and another full degree in Fahrenheit.
And so what happens? I mean, so that, you know, people talk about 2 degrees centigrade relative, an increase of 2 degrees centigrade relative to pre-industrial times is something of a threshold. But what happens as the temperature gets warmer? It's not just a matter of having to shed a few layers of clothing. So
yeah, I mean,
what are the serious side effects?
The whole, like, natural systems would get out of whack. Rainfall patterns, you know, what the main models indicate, and they're increasingly converging. There are 14 main climate models, and they're getting better and better, that the tropics would become drier and drier, that certain areas in temperate zones would get wetter and wetter, and that as the oceans warm, there would be aquatic extinctions. And, you know, humanity gets something like 80% of its protein from the sea, so that's quite serious. Then one of the main problems in terms of nonlinear climate change is that these feedback loops might set in. So, for example, if the permafrost in the Arctic gets warm enough, then what could happen is there could be a release of lots and lots of trapped methane gas that is permanently frozen and sealed into the earth. And methane is a super potent greenhouse gas. So if the far north gets warm enough, then this methane will come out, and then the warming trend will accelerate even faster. Or as the ice sheets melt, the sun's the reflective power of the ice is replaced by the absorbing power of dark water, and so then the rate at which the planet is heating will accelerate.
Okay, where are these greenhouse gases coming from? What industries and what countries?
Well, I mean, mainly the industrialized, you know, economies of the world, and the primary gas is carbon dioxide, which is a byproduct of burning oil and coal. And coal is really, in some ways, the main culprit in the long history of industrialization. Half of the U.S. electricity comes from coal. China is heavily dependent on coal. So the U.S. currently produces most greenhouse gases, but China is quickly catching up. And in this issue, you know, we try and focus on the United States' special responsibility to change technology and to get out in front of dealing with climate change. And that's what, you know, in my piece on green utilities, I was trying to sort of, you know, not collapse into total despair and look at the ways in which there are possible solutions to this, and the fact that there is, in fact, billions of dollars, despite, you know, proper regulation, despite proper incentives from the government. In fact, with all the, you know, all of the government planning, doing everything it can to bolster the power of fossil fuels, there's still, in fact, you know, significant investment in green utilities to create carbon-free forms of electricity.
I want to come back to this after we look at China a bit. And there's a piece in the issue by Elizabeth Economy, who is a fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. And China is becoming increasingly important as a emitter of greenhouse gases. And that's mainly because of its incredible rates of economic growth, 11% over the last year or so. And the government has committed itself to reducing the energy component of its economic growth. They want to get, reduce the energy component of GDP by about 20%. But in the past year, the economy grew 11%, electricity use grew 15%, so they've got those numbers backwards. Just the other day, the Chinese missed decided to postpone indefinitely the release of their greenhouse gas strategy. So they seem, I don't know, a little embarrassed or nervous or don't know what to say, but kind of bad news. So Elizabeth Economy could not guarantee that she could be here to be on the phone at this moment. So I recorded something with her yesterday. Let's listen to Elizabeth Economy. You say in your piece that the industrialized nations of the world started the climate problem, but China may finish the job. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think what we've seen over the past few years is that China has moved up far more rapidly, becoming one of the world's largest emitters of greenhouse gases, in particular carbon dioxide, and originally was set to surpass the United States as the largest contributor by 2020 or so. And then last year we heard from the International Energy Agency they were going to surpass the United States by 2009 as the largest emitter of carbon dioxide, and now we're hearing that, in fact, is going to happen this year, so that as China is adding roughly one coal-fired power plant every 7 to 10 days, and the rest of the world is thinking about how to cut back and cut down on their carbon dioxide emissions, it seems that China is really pushing forward and advancing in its development and in its contribution to global climate change.
How seriously will China itself be affected by climate change?
The Chinese government, particularly those in the that work in the State Meteorological Administration or the Ministry of Science and Technology, are extremely concerned about the potential impact of climate change on China. And they point in particular to crop yields that are expected to decline by as much as 30%, or the fact that rising sea levels could, in essence, submerge an area the size of Portugal along China's coastal region, which is, of course, the wealthiest and most industrialized region of the country, particularly along Shanghai. And they're concerned about the rate at which the glaciers on the Tibetan Qinghai Plateau are melting, and the fact that this will cause not only flooding at some point in time, but inevitably and eventually very severe droughts, which China, as a water-short country, can ill afford.
China has made a lot of noise about increasing its energy efficiency dramatically, which would have a byproduct of reducing greenhouse gas emissions. They continuously fail, which surprises a lot of people. Even just a couple of weeks ago, I heard Nicholas Stern give a talk at Columbia, and he said, well, Chinese have ways of making people comply, which provoked laughter from the audience. But everyone assumes that what the government wants gets done. What's going on?
Yeah, I think this is sort of one of the great misunderstandings of China and its political system, is that what Beijing says goes. And in fact, we see across any number of issues, whether you're talking about environmental protection or intellectual property rights protection or public health issues, that what Beijing says very rarely goes at the local level. And China made the decision to decentralize authority to local officials 3 decades ago, and basically put local officials in charge of developing the economy and of providing for the social welfare of the people. And while they've done a very good job of developing the economy, they haven't done a very good job of providing for the social welfare of the people, and certainly not for protecting the environment. But at this point, really, Beijing has very few levers of control at the local level. Environmental Protection Bureau officials report to the local government, not to Beijing. And local officials, for them, the incentive is to continue to grow their economy. There really is no reason at this point in time for them to make environmental protection a number one priority.
Now, it's sometimes said that China really needs 10% rates of economic growth just to maintain social stability. Do you agree with that?
Well, I think, what people often say and what the Chinese government itself says is that, at 7%, growth in the economy, that's what they need to, as you say, to continue to maintain social stability, to continue to employ the Chinese people as they're laying them off in the state-owned enterprises and develop new employment opportunities. In fact, though, I think what the government is increasingly realizing is that it's pushing the economic development sort of on the back of the environment, and the environment is beginning to fight back. In fact, you can find many areas in China now where the environment is beginning to impinge on economic growth. Or, for example, in 2005, the government announced it had lost $35 billion in industrial output because it didn't have enough water to run its factories. So I think slowly but surely the Chinese leadership is coming to the recognition that, 10% economic growth, and in any case it seems often to surpass that, but 10% economic growth and the very irrational way that it develops with the sort of heavy industry, the steel, the cement, et cetera, all of these provincial officials just developing these heavy industries, energy-intensive industries, pell-mell, that this is not going to be sustainable. So I think that there is a slow realization within the government that this is that this kind of statistic setting is not especially helpful.
Last month, China became a net importer of coal for the first time. How serious are the resource constraints on economic growth?
Well, I think the issue of the coal supply is a somewhat complicated one because a lot of it has to do with the transportation networks, which have been a very long-standing problem. It has to do with the issue of the small coal mines, which the government periodically shuts down and then they open up again, which promotes some kind of instability in supply. And it has to do with the fact that the coal mines oftentimes don't like the price that the electric power companies are willing to pay for the coal. So there are a lot of different factors. More broadly speaking, of course, China is a huge resource-driven economy at this point in time, and it's in Africa, Latin America, and Southeast Asia looking for oil and natural gas and copper and timber and everything that it needs to continue to grow its economy. So as we think about China's environmental impact and the impact of its growth, it's clear that it's not simply going to be in this issue of global climate change, but very much a factor of how Chinese multinationals and the Chinese government are contributing to shape environment throughout the rest of the world, very much on a sort of local ground level.
Now, they're investing something like 40% of GDP, which is just at or close to a world record. There's an enormous amount of investment going on. Are they going to have a serious overcapacity problem somewhere along the line?
Well, this is certainly something Beijing has been harping on for almost a decade now. And again, it's a perfect example of the issue that you raised earlier, which is the extent to which Beijing actually controls what goes on at the local level. So the issue of overcapacity, the issue of local officials simply developing their own steel capacity, their own coal mines, their own cement factories, their own pulp and paper mills, the irrationality of all of this is something that is of significant concern to the top leadership, but they have shown very little ability to rein in this kind of spending, in part because local banks and local bank officials are tied to local government officials. And when they say we need, a loan to develop this enterprise or this industry, they get it without any sort of check on whether this really makes sense. So this has been a very intractable problem for Beijing.
You make it sound like it's almost a hopeless problem unless China has some sort of economic accident and stops growing altogether. They won't be able to get on top of this situation. Is there any hope that they will?
Well, I think, if we're talking about the environment, I think that there is a lot of room for improvement on the Chinese front by, changing some of the incentive structures, for local officials and for local business people, really to make it easy for them to do the right thing. So what does that mean? That means, for example, that they need to change the price of water. So, water cannot be priced at 20% of replacement cost and have that encourage conservation or efficiency or wastewater treatment, right? It just doesn't make sense for factories at that point. They need to, raise the fines for polluting enterprises and then be able to enforce those fines. So they need investment in capacity building for local Environmental Protection Bureau officials. And I think on the sort of the political side as well, the Chinese government has been quite schizophrenic. And, on the one hand, they recognize the advantage of promoting the rule of law, of allowing civil society, environmental NGOs, to act as a watchdog on local officials in the environment, and to allow the media to do these kinds of exposés of pollution accidents and corruption, et cetera, in the field of the environment. So you have these periods of time when these kinds of things are promoted, and then you have the times when government's fear of a color revolution overwhelms them, and you see them being slapped back. So we just saw, for example, an environmental activist who just won an award this fall for his activities in cleaning up one of China's three major lakes, the Tai Lake. We just saw him arrested a few days ago. So I think that there is this kind of balance that the Chinese government has yet to find between their desire to open up society, to be able to improve the environment and to enhance environmental protection, and their concern that somehow this is going to lead to a broader movement for political reform.
And that's the voice of Elizabeth Economy, a fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations and author of a book that came out several years ago on the Chinese environment called The River Runs Black. And she is the author of a piece in the Nation's special issue on climate change, which came out last week and is still up on the web at thenation.com. So check it out. And now we're rejoining in the studio here, Christian Parenti, a guest editor of that special issue. And Christian, you were talking before the break about alternatives to despair, which is very tempting when one studies this this area at all. And you're looking for cleaner forms of electricity. So tell us about that.
I mean, it seems to me that if there it was to be, if we're going to deal with the problem of climate change, it has to happen now, which means we can't wait for a socialist revolution or anything like that. This system, capitalism, has to deal with it. There are certain vested interests, the oil and coal industry.
Now, there are people who say capitalism can't deal with it. It's impossible.
Right.
You don't buy that.
I don't think that's totally true. I mean, you could say that there's a fundamental contradiction between capitalism and nature, but there are also specific contradictions that capitalism has overcome in its history. And there are previous moments in capitalist history where it confronts local and specific natural limits and reforms to deal with that, and we could see climate change as being the final act, or hopefully one of these more limited contradictions that it can deal with. So these vested interests, the coal and oil industries, are going to have to be euthanized and gotten out of the way. That's the most difficult thing. But then there's the technical question, like, is there enough money? Are there technologies? Could we actually feed industrial society the energy it needs? And I think fundamentally we could. It would be difficult, but there's a lot of options. I mean,
some of the opponents or people who are skeptical about warming climate change will say that this is all just disguised austerity program, and that the only way you can get down emissions is by deeply cutting into the standard of living of average people, and this is all just a trick by the rich, by liberal elites. You hear this on some sort of Marxist dinosaur say things like that, but also you hear it on the populist right. You're not arguing for the hair shirt, are you?
No, I'm not. I mean, you could make the case that it would actually be a type of green Keynesianism, that the overaccumulation of capital, the over capacity in so many industries, the massive unemployment all over the planet, that those irrationalities in the system could be overcome with planning, whereby state action put that capital and labor to work building a new carbon neutral infrastructure. And at the center of that would be the electrical grid, which also has to be basically rebuilt because of 30 years of deregulation. There hasn't been proper investment here in the U.S. But you just think about real basic, what needs to happen? There needs to be electric vehicles that plug into the grid at one end. And at the other end, we need to remove coal plants and put in stuff like gigantic wind farms, which are being built. And the largest power plant built in New York State last year was a wind farm. There's a huge solar farm going online in Tucson. There's a lot of this stuff. Wind capacity in the United States grew by one-third last year. And if there was proper organization within these industries, if there was proper incentives, and if there was severe and merciless carbon taxes on coal and oil, you could see a radical rapid growth in alternative energy, which would create jobs and revitalize regions that have been plagued by deindustrialization. And already there's some of that happening, that one of the main regions where they're building wind turbines is in the Midwest. Pennsylvania, just in an old U.S. steel plant, opened a major wind turbine factory. There are possibilities. It's not. I wouldn't want to put too rosy a gloss on it and say, "Oh, it's just." It would be really simple, and actually, we would get richer and richer, and everybody would be happy all the time if we made this transition. It would involve real changes. And one of the pieces in the issue that I think is very crucial in all this is the question of air travel. That's something that there is no easy solution for. And if we're really going to deal with this, we are probably going to have to fly less. And that is that does translate into a lowering of one's standard of living if you're used to flying a lot, as I know many of us are.
Well, so what about these alternative ways of generating electricity? They're pretty small scale now, and the capital investment is pretty high. Is it practical to generate the kinds of quantities of electricity that we use now using less damaging methods.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you'd have, you know, if there was proper investment, you know, well, one thing is, you know, the main renewable is hydropower. Already 9% of America's electricity is produced by hydropower. When America was first electrified, hydropower was king. In the 1920s, almost half of all power was from hydropower.
Now, if I had somebody here for the International Rivers Network, they would say hydropower is very damaging.
Yeah, well, mega dams are very damaging, but you don't need to build, you know, Grand Coulee dams and Hoover dams just to make electricity from water. There is, in the East River, it's a small power plant, only 10 megawatts, but what's called kinetic hydropower, where they just sink the turbines into really what's a tidal estuary. And so you don't dam the water and channel it and create artificial levels of pressure in the water to then spin your turbines. You just use the natural movement of the water, and you submerge turbines in the water and catch the in and outflow of the tide and generate electricity from that. So that's a very, you know, harmless way to use hydropower. Also, you know, most dams in the United States, small dams, many of which are being taken down, but not all of which are being taken down, most of them don't have any hydro capacity on them. And if we were serious about saving ourselves from, you know, potential civilizational meltdown with a radical, you know, collapse of the climate system, we would have to retrofit those dams and, you know, use them. And, you know, yes, dams are damaging, but we also have to realize that if there is runaway climate change where the feedback loop set in so that the process of warming accelerates the process of warming and you get radically rising sea levels over the next 100, 150 years, people are talking about, you know, possibly 20 feet in a century if nonlinear climate change kicks in. If that happens, you know, rivers, riparian habitat is screwed. So we have to kind of cut our losses on some of this stuff. Yes, windmills do kill birds and bats. They're getting a lot better at not killing them. They don't kill as many as buildings in major cities do. There are impacts for alternative fuels, but they're minuscule compared to the potential damage of business as usual. I mean, everything could potentially fall apart if we just carry on our merry way.
I'm speaking with Christian Parenti, a frequent contributor to The Nation, who is the editor of that magazine's guest editor of the magazine's special issue on global warming. And, well, what about the politics of this? My piece in the issue is about elite responses, and we're seeing. When I started writing, researching the piece in January, it seemed like not much was going on. By the time I finished it in April, things had changed dramatically. So there's a remarkable change of consciousness and organization and activity at the top levels of society. We're seeing increasing interest in corporate America, at least part of it, interest in some parts of Wall Street. It does seem like something is happening at the elite level. Are we going to have to rely on the elites to do it for us, or will a mass movement keep them honest? What about the politics? Where is the political energy going to come from?
Yeah, I mean, hopefully there'll be a mass movement, but also the time frame, such as it is going to require that elites get serious about trying to save the system that they dominate and benefit from. I mean, typically reform, which ends up being good for capitalists, is forced upon capitalists by insurgent movements, workers, peasants, whatever, demanding a humanization of the system. There are moments in the history of capitalism, like the Progressive Era, where nature threatens the system. In the Progressive Era, there was, you know, typhoid and various types of diseases that almost acted as a kind of natural biological insurgency, which caused the professional classes to rally and organize a society, create garbage cleanup, water systems, public health systems, those types of things. So hopefully there might be something like that going on with climate change. I mean, what do you think, having done the research, why are various sections of elites now taking this seriously, or are they taking it seriously? Is this just the most sophisticated greenwashing we've ever seen, or is there some sort of change underway?
Well, I think some people are serious enough to see the science and get scared. They have to live here too. And if the places they live in, the coastal cities, most people live in the coasts, and if they start flooding, there's not much you can do with your money then. Mm-hmm. This street we're on right now, Wall Street, is, as they say, begins in a graveyard and ends in a river. the river and the graveyard will meet if this continues unabated. I think there are enough intelligent people who can see by the end of their noses, beyond the end of their noses, that something bad is happening and something must be done soon and seriously. But, you know, we have this classic contradiction of life under capitalism. The most salient incentives that people have operating on them are, you know, next quarter's profits. Mm-hmm. And so we can't rely on market mechanisms to do this spontaneously. And we can't rely on high-minded intentions and think tank reports and that. It does seem like it's going to require state action. It's almost as if some of these more enlightened wing of the bourgeoisie is actually saying, make us do something. Please, state, make us do something.
Right. Well, I mean, they're actually saying that, right? I mean,
some are, yeah. It was amazing that the chairs of the big three U.S. auto companies and Toyota spoke before Congress a few weeks ago and basically said, regulate us. Mm-hmm. And they're interested in having consistent regulations because they're afraid of the states coming in and doing all different things. I think they'd like to have some kind of international pattern of regulation to deal with. But I think the more intelligent of these folks realize that something has to be done and it's going to take state action to do it and state subsidy to do it. State subsidy for R&D. And, mm-hmm. You know, look at the industries that the United States, U.S. industry is still strong in. Pharmaceuticals, computing, aerospace. Agribusiness, aerospace, all of those have very, very heavy federal involvement.
Yeah.
And it's hard to imagine anything of the sort you're talking about happening, developing new means of power generation without some kinds of serious subsidies of R&D. I was stunned to learn when we heard Nicholas Stern at Columbia the other week that energy R&D has been halved over the last couple of decades. It's, you know, exactly the wrong thing.
It's insane. And currently there is zero money given to geothermal research. I mean, none at all. It's shocking. It's along these lines, what I found most disturbing, I think it's, you know, all the pieces in this issue, I think, directly or subtextually really argue for, you know, the leading role of the state to guide capitalism in the direction that you're talking about. And that's what, in accepting that capitalism has to face this problem, we're not saying that, like, the market can do it on its own, but that the whole social system. But one of the things that was most depressing about dealing with the renewable energy business sector was how timid and cowed they were, so that they weren't demanding anything from the state. What they were all about was proving how they could, you know, make money and how they didn't need the production tax credit. There is a small production tax credit which helps stabilize the market there. But it was it seemed to me that there had been like a real ideological victory over these sectors, that they weren't acting the way the coal industry or the oil industry acts, which is to demand government support. And which is exactly what they need to do if they're gonna grow.
They need to be a little more tough and manly, like the oil industry. Yes. All right. Thanks, Christian. We're out of time. I've been speaking with Christian Parenti, a frequent contributor to The Nation magazine and a guest editor of that magazine's special issue on climate change, which you can find on the web now at thenation.com and probably in a few newsstands and maybe in your mailbox if you subscribe. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Stay tuned for the news and on into the evening. And let's go out with a little bit of this new song from Electra Lane's forthcoming album.